to what we're talking about.
Please stand by. Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Grey Light Capital Speaker Series. Today's presentation is being recorded. Now I'd like to turn the conference over to Michael Reeves. Please go ahead, sir.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this quarter's Greylock Capital Speaker Series event. I'm Michael Reeves, and I lead our marketing and investor relations efforts here at Greylock Capital, along with Caitlin Conroy and our newest team member, Victoria Collier, who is helping us through Caitlin's upcoming maternity leave. If you were here dialed in for our last event focused on the future of China with NPR correspondent and author Scott Tong, you know that the purpose of these events is not to talk about Greylock per se, but to bring in distinguished guest speakers and authors that can give really context to the emerging markets so that we all become better informed investors and allocators. In a moment, I'll ask our founder, Hans Humes, to introduce our speaker today. But suffice it to say that we're delighted to have Mr. Rhodes with us this afternoon. Bill Rhodes is currently the president and CEO of William R. Rhodes Global Advisors, which he founded back in 2010. After 53 years with Citigroup and his predecessor companies, retiring as, from Citi as Senior Vice Chairman and Senior International Officer. If you've read his book, Banker to the World, you'll know we're in for some great stories and perspective. For those here in the room, please be sure to stay for a few minutes afterwards to get your copy of Banker to the World signed. For those on the conference line, we'll be sending books your way. Also, for those with us here, it looks like the rain is mostly stopped, but we've just gotten some Greylock umbrellas made, so if you want to grab an umbrella on the way out to keep you dry in the sun, feel free. Hans, you've known Bill an awful lot longer than I have, so if you want to go ahead and introduce Bill?
Sure. When Michael came up with the idea of having a speaker series, it really was a matter of when, not if, we would have Bill speak to us. My background with Bill goes back to me serving coffee to him when I was on the support staff for the old manufacturer's Hanover, which was probably the highest indebted of the major banks when I started in the industry. But the team that was at Manny Hanny that were, for the most part, all people who'd worked for Bill at Citibank. Bill was in the eye of the storm when the Latin American debt crisis hit. He managed the process in a way that I, for all the ups and downs, managing the process so the banks didn't come apart at the seams, and the Latin American economies, while they went through some serious crisis, emerged stronger. I think there are few, if any, other people other than Bill who could have managed it in such a way. The template that he set in terms of coordinating activities with the financial institutions, the U.S. government, the international official sector, is one that we hope that we can continue and duplicate in some of the efforts that we're embarked on now. Venezuela is an example, but you know, as I said, when I started in the industry, I was privileged enough to serve coffee to Bill.
Shows you how old I am.
And he was always seen as one of the absolute luminaries. His contacts, connections internationally are unparalleled, and his perspective on many of the issues that are facing the international financial community now. You know, he's got insight few others have. So with that, I turn it over to Bill.
Thank you very much, Hans. Hans asked me to talk a little bit about the restructuring process going way back and maybe some of the lessons learned. You've already heard about China, but you know, my views on China and others may be a little different. I've been there in the last 25, 27 years, 80, 90 times. And so I have my views out. And I had asked that my op-ed in Reuters of January 18th be circulated. If you don't have it, then you might want to read it. I stick by what I said then. I called for a 10 to 20% adjustment in the market. It sat with the Financial Times because they thought it was too strong for a week. And then I just put it in Reuters because I wanted to get it out. And it was 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks before you know, the market took the hit 12%, and it's been highly volatile ever since. And I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to see that it was overbought, but it was amazing how many people didn't see it. But that's the way it always is. That's the way it was in 2006 and 2007 when I, then the Financial Times published it on the first page, and I called it, because a lot of these things become self-evident, and a lot of it I picked up actually in the restructuring process, because there are a lot of elements in that when you see markets are overbought, and you see that, you know, the search and reach for yield, whether it be sovereigns, individual companies, markets, really are the signal every time that there's going to be a major adjustment, and some are worse than others, and you have to work your way through. On the debt restructuring process, we went through some major changes. We all think of the Latin American debt crisis starting in 1982 with Mexico in August. There had been some symptoms before. I had already restructured Jamaica, I think, for the first time. I think I restructured it three times. It must have been restructured three times more. I think that must hold the record, along with Argentina, the country most restructured. And then I did Nicaragua, except there the Nicaraguans decided that, having signed it, they didn't want to implement it. And it's interesting because there was a young guy, young Mexican guy called Angel Gurria, who was seconded by the Ministry of Finance. It was one of his first jobs, I think, the Ministry of Finance, to be the advisor to the Nicaraguans. That's when I first started dealing with him, which would be 1980. As you know, he went on to be the head debt restructurer for Mexico all during the 80s and early 90s, became Minister of Finance, Foreign Minister, and now is running the OECD. So it's very interesting how a lot of careers started in this business. When we got into the Latin American debt crisis, was really, though, provoked by Mexico in August, in August 82. And what had happened is, if you remember your history, if you read about it, because most of you are pretty young here, and so you probably have to read about it, you wouldn't have experienced it, but we had the oil embargoes and all the problems with oil under President Ford, you know, with the Middle East. All of these countries that were in OPEC were making tremendous, and even those that weren't in OPEC, like Mexico, were making tremendous amounts of money because the price of oil and gas zoomed, mainly oil. And so the powers that be at the G7 decided that this money needed to be recycled. And I was going over this with Paul Volcker the other day, because he's finishing up his memoirs, which will come out later this year. And he's got a chapter on this, and we went through all of this and just recently. And then a former official of the International Monetary Fund is actually doing a new study on this whole period for Lessons Learned, and he was in my office for 2 hours the other day also. Jacques de la Rosière, who was head of the International Monetary Fund at the time, in my opinion, the greatest head of the International Monetary Fund ever, then went on to run the Banque de France and so many other major institutions, the French Treasury, etc. But we were going over this period as to what lessons were learned. And, of course, in those days, with the recycling process, you had had the invention of LIBOR 10 years earlier. And that was done by a Greek investment banker with Credit Suisse First Boston. Zambanikas was his name. And suddenly something that had been developed, you know, for the London market suddenly became, you know, the rate on which you would base all sorts of lending, particularly to the emerging markets, the sovereigns, and then it got into everything that you would do, LIBOR. And as you know, the powers that be and the Bank of England and the Fed don't want to use LIBOR anymore, because they say it was artificially manipulated. And so for the last 5 years, I've been trying to get the banks to change. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago where they went over six possibilities. And it's one of these things where the regulators want you to change it, yet they don't want their hands on it. And you know all the scandals that came out over LIBOR and people losing their jobs, CEOs, et cetera, bankers going, traders going to jail and one thing or another. But the period where LIBOR really got installed in the business was that period in the 70s, in that recycling period. And, of course, what happened is that at that point in time, interest rates started out very low. And since you had a floating rate over LIBOR, when my friend Paul Volcker was called in by Jimmy Carter to kill inflation because we were on our way to an inflationary spiral that resembled something coming out of Latin America. And so what Paul did was what you'd expect him to do. He raised interest rates significantly. And suddenly these countries, the sovereigns, not only in Latin America, but in Africa, in Asia, Eastern Central Europe, suddenly they found that their debt service was overpowering. And the first one to hit the skids was Mexico, because under López Portillo, the then president and his predecessor, they had borrowed very heavily against their oil income. And so they were first to hit the skids. I mean, interest rates went from 3, 4, 5% up to over 20%. And you can imagine what that did to debt service. So that was the beginning of the crisis. But rather than going in point by point, I would just say that it's important to understand that these were bank loans priced over LIBOR. Very few bonds. There were a few bonds, but mainly some of the Swiss banks had issued them. But basically, bonds were not part of the action in those days. And so what we had to do, and this is the origin, really, of the restructuring committees. The last time you faced anything like this was in the Great Depression, when you had these bank restructuring committees, mainly for countries in Europe and some in Latin America. But you had to go back, if you're a historian, to look to the 1920s and the 1930s, the last time that you had bank restructuring committees. So we were sort of starting out anew. One of the early meetings we had the president, Manny Hanny, there at the time. And I remember when we were trying to put on Mexico together the initial cable to the banks around the world, that just to let them know that the Mexicans couldn't service their debt anymore. I remember him telling Bill, put all the boilerplate you can in that, because, you know, this is a real sales job, because these banks aren't going to want to cooperate. And boy, was he right. And so we got into the point of not only restructuring, but then Jacques de la Rosière, who was running the IMF, who, as I said, I think was the greatest head of the IMF ever, and most people who've been in the IMF agree to that. We've had some that haven't been so good, but he certainly was the best. He looked at the figures, and here's the man who ran the French Treasury, and saw that they didn't add up with just, you know, pushing forward the principal and even taking major discounts in interest rates. So he said, you got to put in new money. And, of course, that's the last thing that the banks wanted to do, because, you know, it's the old story. You've never put good money into bad. It just makes it worse. And so we went through a number of sessions. I remember one at the New York Fed when Jock came up, and they called the heads of all the major banks of the world, the major banks of the United States, Canada, Europe, and Asia, which were major at that point was the Japanese banks. And Jock came up, and I was trying to get a vacation for a change, and I was down in St. Martin, and I got a call from Walter Wriston, who was the chairman, who was sort of the lead banker of this day, saying, Bill, you got to get up here. And I said, well, I don't know the flights. And he said, I'll send my plane down. And here I am sitting with the heads of all the major banks of the world and the head of the New York Fed and Jacques Desrosiers, and I was supposed to represent the chairman of the senior banks of the world. That was quite something at my stage of the career and age. And he basically said, gentlemen, if you don't put in new money in addition to restructuring the principal and interest, there'll be no IMF funds going in. And so it's up to you. He said, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Bill Rhodes, who's chairing. At that point, I was chairing like four committees, Mexico, Argentina, Uruguay, Peru. I hadn't picked up Brazil. I did that a few months later. And he said, Bill, you run the meeting. I hope that your associates here, and these are all CEOs, chairmen, that they come up with the right decision. Well, they really had no other alternative. And one of the banks, as Hans has mentioned, that would have gone under probably was Manny Hanny at that time. And there were a couple others that were also in that shape. I mean, all of them would have been hurt, but I mean, there were some that really had extended themselves. Lloyds was another in the UK, which had lent heavily through to Latin America. So that's how it had to be. What this began is, and the reason I'm going into this, Hans asked me to, and I said, people are going to be bored with this. He said, no, you got to give the background to this, is that it showed that when you go into a major sovereign debt restructuring, if possible, you want to have the International Monetary Fund with you. And if you usually want to have the finance ministries and central banks with you, because that gives an aura of some sort of support on a basis that the sovereign countries can accept, because it's not just the banks. You have the International Monetary Fund, in some cases backed by the World Bank and the other IFIs, and the central banks and the ministries of finance of the developed world there. So that sort of gave cover to everything. And that was the way we proceeded. And one thing that stayed the same is normally in a major, major sovereign restructuring, you normally, not always the case, but you normally should get the IMF involved, because that's a cover, face cover for the sovereign itself, but also for getting support from the individual governments around the world, because they depend on the IMF to do that. But as I said, everything was done on the basis of LIBOR loans. And then I won't go through everything that happened. Brazil happened later. That was interesting because Brazil was the biggest out there, and the initial restructuring didn't work very well. They had someone from Morgan Guarantee and someone from Citi, and the banks revolted and went to Paul Volcker and said, and the Brazilian government, we can't deal with this. Well, unfortunately, one of the representative from Morgan, and this has always been a great stain on Morgan, ended up in jail, Tony Gebauer, because it turns out he was taking money out of his clients' accounts. And there was a book, the play on Hamilton. Well, the author of that play, first major book, was on the House of Morgan. And he spent like 4 hours with me going over that particular situation of Brazil. And the chapter is called Samba. And so we ended up also there. And the whole idea here was, which I think is still a major point, is that the banks had to work together. And we tried to split up responsibility so everyone felt they had something in the game. And when I say split it up, like we tried to put together an economic committee, we split up geographically. I remember in the United States, it was Manny Hanny who had the responsibility for the U.S. banks, because Manny Hanny had the best working relationship with the U.S. banks on correspondent banking. And, the representative from the U.K. would have the U.K. banks, the German banks, all stuff that makes sense then, now. But, at the time, we were kind of doing everything from anew. And so everyone felt they had something in the game on getting this thing done. And one of the things I learned there was to go around the table and make sure everyone had a chance to speak, rather than do it in the normal investment banking area where you shove it down someone's throat, because that wouldn't work. So everyone had his chance to opine, give his or her thoughts, and we had a number of women, very strong women, who were sat around the table, one from Manny Hanny, who now runs the Council of America Society, Susan Siegel, who was a trainee under me at Citi in Venezuela, and a number of others. And so we became sort of a band of brothers and sisters here because we all felt we were doing something positive for the country as well as the institutions we worked for and the system, because the system almost went down. One of the jokes about the IMF World Bank meetings in Toronto in September 1982, they talked about it reshuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. And this is where I first met Paul Volcker, because the central bank heads were concerned with these rising rates, which Paul had to do to kill inflation, the dragon of inflation, which is what he's most famous for. What people don't realize, and that's why he's going to have a chapter in his book about it, is the work he did with Jacques Desrosiers and I, the bank representative, on basically keeping the system out of a Great Depression. Because the major banks of the world were really overlent and undercapitalized. So when you think about 2007, 2008, it ain't the first time it's happened. And one of the things Paul used to tell me, he said, you know, Bill, he said, banks keep making the same mistakes every 10 years. They don't seem to learn. And I said, well, you know, I think it's worse now, Paul, because so many of the banks are run by ex-investment bankers, and it's no longer every 10 years. I think it's every 5 years. But, you know, history which is why I guess Hans wanted me to get in, will show you a lot. So from that early period, what did we learn? We learned that you needed to work within the system. You needed to work with your colleagues so that you were on the same wavelength. And you had to have the support of the International Monetary Fund. The sovereign governments needed to make everything work together. And, of course, we're still talking about LIBOR loans. So then things were dragging out. We had a multi-year restructuring in Mexico because the original one wasn't long enough. And then Jim Baker became Secretary of Treasury, and he had been chief of staff to Ronald Reagan, but he decided he wanted to do something else. And so he came up with a Baker plan, which I helped implement, which was actually to give additional money to these countries. But a number of the countries said, look, we don't want just new money to pay off the debts to the banks. We sort of want a reduction in principal and interest, because, you know, we're never going to be able to pay off this debt, and we've got to get realistic about it. And Nick Brady came into office, who was an investment banker, and he and Bush, this is Bush 1, sat down and said, you know, it's about time we do something different here. At the same time, John Reed, who had come in as CEO and chairman of Citibank, decided that he wanted to take a big reserve on this. And, of course, one of the banks most affected was Manny Hanny, because, unfortunately, John didn't bother to tell the other bank heads that he was doing this. And we had this working together to try and work our way out. So you had two streams going here. One, John Reed with his big reserve, which put a lot of pressure on a number of banks, mainly Manny Hanny and others, and the Mexicans and Nick Brady deciding that you really couldn't go on the basis and you had to have debt relief. And so what was the debt relief? It became the Brady Plan. And Nick Brady turned it over. He wanted it to be known as the Bush Plan, but because that's the type of guy Brady is. But Bush was smart and decided
you're going to do this. We're going to name it after you. Because I think he thought it might not work. Good politician. And so it became the Brady Plan. And so I went down working with Treasury, David Mulford and Charles Dallara, on setting out what this would be. And basically what it was, there were two options initially, and then I suggested a third, which they had to go into because there wasn't enough funding. Initially, it was either you would take a hit in either your principal or your interest, and bonds would be issued, the Brady bonds, and the international financial institutions agreed to help support that, but there still wasn't enough money there. And so I convinced Angel Gurria that there were some institutions, turns out Citibank was one and some others, who had, you know, faith that the thing would work out over time and wanted to put in new money rather than take a hit on interest and principal. So you had those three options on the table. But the main thing about the Brady Plan was that you were in a new world. The debt was securitized. You were no longer talking about loans over LIBOR. And what have we had ever since? Bonds. So the securitization of the debt changed the whole face of sovereign and corporate restructuring in the emerging markets. So that was something that was key at that time, which we have, to this day. And of course, subsequent to doing the Brady Plan, you had some additional, you had the tequila crisis and one thing or another. You've had a number of crises that come on, but the basics have stayed on there. And each case is different because although we had the Brady, the Brady scheme and bonds and Brady Plan, each country had a different menu of options, you know, suited to the country. So there was no cookie-cutter approach, and there still isn't. Hans has worked through this for years and years, and knows no individual restructuring is ever completely the same because there are different characteristics. You have, different profiles on the debt, different amounts of the debt, different sovereigns, et cetera. But the basic point is we're no longer talking about loans over LIBOR here. We're talking about bonds. And a number of these bonds, which weren't supposed to be restructured, have been restructured. So there's always something new, and you can never say never in this business. And the latest one, after the travails of Argentina, only resolved because Macri came into office and understood that something had to be done. And you now have Venezuela, which is, as someone had said, is going to be, quoting Saddam Hussein, it's going to, when he said the mother of all battles, this is supposed to be the mother of all restructurings, given the size and the complexity and who's running the government. Because one of the things we had in almost all instances is that the sovereign, could sit down with the International Monetary Fund. There were a lot of differences and stuff and work stuff out over time, and the central bank heads would get together and work things out. Well, you sort of have Argentina became somewhat of a pariah, but not completely out of the system. Venezuela is more of a pariah, sort of out of the system, being supported by China and Russia. And that's a new instance also. The Chinese got involved very heavily over 10 years ago. I advised them, the oil companies there, they're all state-owned, and SOEs, and that they ought to be very careful about investing in Venezuela. I lived there 13 years. I knew what was going on there. It was under Chavez, and I knew Chavez well. I guess it's more than that. It's almost, they started to get in big, be more than 10, maybe 14, 15 years ago, the first Chinese investment went in the oil company. And basically, the heads of all the major oil companies said, Bill, this isn't our decision. This is basically what the leaders of the country want. Because what they were looking for was to get their hands under resources. And since China is not a great producer of oil and gas, and as a matter of fact, the production has come down over the last 30, 40 years to what it used to be. So they were looking for this more on a strategic basis than anything else. And, of course, a lot of these Chinese oil companies now are very concerned about getting repayment. And the Russians have gotten themselves involved also, of course. The Chinese, I don't think, have much of a geopolitical look at this. It's basically a business look. whereas the Russians are very much geopolitical also. And they are in there because they see this also as a tie-in with Cuba and also as a possibility to influence the United States in one way or the other. So, you know, those are just a few of the lessons learned. I think that in a case like Venezuela, Hans is trying to put together a group, which I think is the right way to go. Someone's got to do it. In the case of Greece, the international finance got too deeply involved. They're not going to do that this time. They're going to be supportive of what Hans is trying to do. They suddenly decide that they want to manage it. And having been the founder of the Institute of International Finance and acting chairman a number of times and first vice chairman emeritus, I tried to tell them, because I had retired from the board by then, that that wasn't their role in life, that their role in life was to be supportive, not to get into restructuring. So they learned that the hard way, and I think that dragged on longer than it had to drag on. And so I think all of these lessons come forward as to how Venezuela needs to be handled. And very importantly, we took a group down to meet with the Undersecretary of State International, because dealing with the U.S. government is something that is going to be key here, because in all of these countries we were dealing with, even the ones we dealt with in Eastern Central Europe, you didn't have sanctions on the country. And, you know, the Treasury has sanctions on Venezuela and may increase those sanctions. So this is really the most complex case that we have to face, because even in Argentina, there are no sanctions on Argentina. So here you have the interest of the second largest economy in the world, China, Russia, and it's something like out of the Great Game, if you go back a century, between Russia and England over northern India and Central Asia. And so you got the Russians, the Chinese, and the Americans all deeply involved in here economically and to an extent politically. So I think this is going to be a very interesting but difficult case. The other thing I would just say about Venezuela before I have a few other comments, then we should open it for questions, you can tell me when, is having lived there 13 years, the country has made itself totally dependent on oil and gas. I mean, they've almost destroyed their other industries, including aluminium, iron ore, and steel, and everything else, which they had a great complex in La Guayana in this area. And they also had a decent farming, farming economy. All of that's gone down the drain. And, of course, here's a country that at one time was producing you go back 20 years ago, they were actually 20, 25 years ago, they were producing 4 million barrels of oil a day. And today, that production is reduced to, what, 1.5 million? They can't even meet 2 million barrels because they haven't reinvested, in the necessary, repairs and infrastructure needed there. When I lived there, it was the golden age of Venezuela, because Venezuela was the one who convinced Saudi Arabia to form OPEC. The name of the minister was Mayobre. And it was the Saudis say it was their idea. It wasn't their idea. It was Mayobre's idea. He went and convinced Saudi Arabia, and that was the formation of OPEC. And so Venezuela, in a sense, helped dominate OPEC. And at any particular time, they could have driven up the production to 4 million barrels a day. So one of the things that's helping the oil market go up here, even though we have more shale gas coming on at any particular time, is Venezuelan production. We don't really know what they're producing. Some people think it's below 2 million barrels a day now. It's not clear because they lie. So you don't really know what the production really is there. But if anything, it's getting worse, notwithstanding, the Chinese coming in and the Russians and everything else. So all of this is what I guess Hans wanted me to do, is give some background to what leading up to Venezuela. I think, you know, a lot of these lessons learned would say to me that we've got to have a working together here between the governments, because it's going to be very difficult to move ahead if we're going to get increased sanctions, by the U.S. government, because this not only affects the U.S. banks, but, you know, we see now what's going on with Russia and the sanctions we put on. Foreign institutions don't want to be sanctioned because they all have, you know, financial institutions, because they all have big business here in the United States. So the real question is what they plan on doing, because Venezuela should be reaping the rewards of this increase in the price of oil from $30 a barrel to over 60. And they're not, because their production keeps dropping and will continue to drop. And what's going on with the people in Venezuela? I've heard so many cases of people I knew down there dying in hospitals. Tuberculosis is running wild. They don't have enough drugs. Seeing what's happened down there, having lived there all that time, you know, it's a killer for me. But what you're going to need is a sovereign to decide that they're serious about wanting to restructure and to work out something with the governments involved. So as I said, because of this, it's the most complex situation, and I give Hans a lot of credit because he's trying to do something about this, which nobody else has really raised their hand to do. So now you've just heard about China. I don't know how much time I have, because you've already heard what's going on in China. And you have my op-ed. I stick with what I said in the op-ed. As far as China goes, it was no surprise to me, and I've given a couple of speeches over the last year or so about what came out of the 19th Party Congress, and what you saw just came out in March meetings. Because when I saw Xi Jinping not naming or tapping a successor at the 19th Party Congress, that's been done ever since Deng Xiaoping, that it was pretty obvious to me that the announcement was going to come out sooner rather than later, that he was going to be leader. I don't know if you want to call it leader for life, because they'll still have the meetings, but there'll be nobody challenging him. And I was fortunate to meet Xi Jinping when he was down in Hangzhou as a party leader, spend an hour and a half with him alone, with a translator. And I came away, and this is now 10 years ago or something, I came before anyone thought he would have a shot at this. I was very impressed. I mean, he is a very strong, smart leader. And when they moved him up to Shanghai to be the party secretary, and that's when everyone started to recognize him, he stepped out of a party Congress meeting, the annual meeting, to spend an hour with me with the translator. I was very impressed with him. I told this to Lee Kuan Yew, who agreed with me, and I told it to Henry Kissinger, who wasn't so sure at the time. And when I saw him not tapping somebody there, it was pretty clear to me what was coming. It was just a matter of time. And so I don't know why people were surprised. He was named core leader. All the things that were either pertinent to Mao Zedong or his predecessor there, Deng Xiaoping. And so I think we're facing a unique situation in China that we haven't seen since Mao Zedong. But China today is not the China of Mao Zedong. It is a world economic power, and it is a world military power. So you're dealing with a different situation. Nuclear armed, so I think the world is going to have to take into account what China is going to do or not do. But that doesn't mean that China doesn't have weaknesses, because they do. Putting all political stuff away, and one of the shrewd things, because Xi Jinping shares something with Deng Xiaoping and Mao, he is a very shrewd political operator. There's been nobody like him, apart from the power he has, I think, in his shrewdness, since either Mao or Deng Xiaoping. And what he has done and what he did when he first stepped in office, he took Wen Qishan, who I got to know very well, who was trained by Zhu Renzhi, who I thought was the best premier China's ever had in modern history. And he's the one who cleaned up China in the 1990s, started to try and change the SOE, state-owned enterprises, cleaned up the banking system, formed asset management companies, had them recapitalized. And one of his proteges, his mentorees, was Wen Qishan, who was cleaned up the mess in Guangdong province for him. And then the SARS epidemic in Beijing, he became the mayor, which is at the time I really got to know him well. And you saw that that he was given the job of corruption. Well, as you know, corruption cuts two ways. One is to fight against corruption. The other is to eliminate your political adversaries. And the two are combined very well. But Wen Qishan is a very shrewd guy. He knows the United States. He and Hank Paulson are very close. He knows a lot of the financial people because when he was vice premier, he was running the China-U.S. dialogue, which Hank Paulson got me involved in. And I think I knew when I gave some speech to some Chinese-American organization 5-6 months ago, and I predicted that even though the age limitation was supposed to catch up with Wen Qishan, they'd find a senior role for him. Well, he is now vice president of China and will be the strongest vice president in modern history because he is so close to Xi Jinping. In addition to that, he has no children vis-a-vis the corruption issue. He's completely loyal to Xi Jinping. Also, I think on the economic side, the financial side, he's made a change in the People's Bank of China. He kept Zhou Xiaoxuan, who's a good friend of mine, for an extra five years when he should have retired because of the competence, and also their fathers were very close. They're both princelings. But Zhou Xiaoxuan had the longest tenure of any head of the central bank in China in history, some 16 years. Very competent person. He spoke out, as you know, at the Party Congress. He was the only one to have a sort of a dissident note when he started talking about the Minsky moment, because he's very concerned about the buildup of debt, which is one of the, I think, one of the Achilles heels of China at this particular point. But in that job, when he left, just announced a couple of weeks ago, they put in the chief technician there, who spent 8 years in the United States, including a professor at the University of Indiana in economics, Yi Gang, who I've got to know very well. And he is very much a reformer. And as a party secretary, because Zhou Xiaoxuan had both jobs, he was both leader of the People's Bank of China, the central bank, and the party secretary. And being party secretary now is more and more important because Xi Jinping is installing the role of party secretary within every company in China, including foreign companies, to be a key role, which has sort of dissipated since the days of Mao. And that's Guo, who had been head of China Construction Bank, was a chief regulator for the CBRC, and governor of Shandong province. And so you have two of the most competent people, and both, by the way, proficient English speakers, both very competent people in the People's Bank. And as I said, you have Wen Qishan there. And so I think they know what China needs to do. The question is when they're going to do it as far as cutting back on the debt, which is over 280% of GDP, the problem of real estate, the state-owned enterprises, the over-indebtedness of municipalities, et cetera. And when that hit comes, I think it's going to affect the growth in China. So far, they've done it slowly but surely. They waited a long time, but they did it. Finally, they took over Aban, which had been allowed to sort of run amok in the sense of not only investing abroad, but in also taking advantage of people's monies And so they stepped in and did that. And so I think they're trying to pull back in a lot of different areas, but I think they have to do it more rapidly. And they've put in as vice premier this fellow Liu, who I do not know, but shares, I'm told, all of views of Wan Qishan and Yigang, all of you, Zhou Shaoxuan, all of these people, that you've got to get control of the debt. You've got to clean up the municipalities. You've got to clean up the state-owned enterprises. The question is the speed to do it. I wrote a number of op-eds, Financial Times and Reuters and everything, about the need to take a look at what Zhu Renji did. And these are all mentorees of his. And so hopefully they will move more rapidly. But so far it appears that they're going to take their time, which could be, I think, a real problem for China going forward, because if you don't deal with this debt problem shortly, it could then become a real problem later on. And we depend very much on China worldwide. Remember, we would have had a Great Depression, not a Great Recession, if the Chinese hadn't pumped in something like $800 billion in 2008 into the, into the world economy. Some people think it may have been a trillion. And they kind of resent that they haven't been given credit for that. Of course, that was the beginning of their buildup of debt, and they've been very slow to do anything about it because the leadership of China didn't want to drop the growth rate below 6%. And, they're estimating the first quarter here is going to be 6.8, and at the year is going to be 6.8. And, of course, you have to question some of those figures. But at some point, they got to make a major adjustment, and that's going to hit the GDP, and that'll affect the world. And this, not even talking about the problems with trade or anything else that you've got involved there. What makes me feel better is you've got pros in the technical jobs here. The question is how much Xi Jinping is going to listen, because the role of Premier of China, which was so powerful under Zhu Renji, is not powerful at all. Li Keqiang is in that role. And he will find that he's already found out, he has less power in that role than any modern premier in Chinese history. And he's got Wan Qishan in there as vice president. And he's also got this fellow Liu. And so it's not clear to me how much power he's going to have. But he basically himself is a reformer. So it really is going to depend on how fast Xi Jinping wants to push reform. Because we've seen nothing like Xi Jinping since Deng Xiaoping, who was a reformer. And my Chinese friends say that Xi Jinping is part Mao and part Deng Xiaoping. Well, let's hope he's more Deng Xiaoping than Mao. But my own interface with him, and then I had a chance when he was vice president, and one incident that I found brilliant. So the last time I really had a chance to talk to him, I used to go regularly to the Boao Forum. And there are all sorts of forums in China, but the one that the Chinese think is most important is Boao on Hainan Island. And this was, I guess, 4 years, 5 years ago, because I was fighting cancer with my wife, who, unfortunately, she had brain cancer, glioblastoma, and she died, so I stopped going at that point, looking after her. And I was given an opportunity with four or five others to meet with Xi Jinping, and I asked him about what he thought, because this was right after Kim Jong-un took over. And basically, the translation was that he's a real pain in the neck, and, he's going to cause problems. So, I mean, the Chinese recognize what they call it. The question is what sort of control they want to exercise over him. And the other thing is that when we talk trade and everything with the Chinese, we've got to understand that we need them with North Korea. So it's not a one-off type operation here. So let's hope we have those in Washington have the ability to manage this properly. So with that, any questions? I probably already run way over time, but I tried to do what you asked me to do.
I think why don't we kick it out to the people on the phone first and see if there are any questions coming from there. I mean, thanks, Bill, for a pretty wide-ranging presentation. I think you've given insight on at least three issues that have been pertinent to our business. So if there are any questions about the history of debt restructuring, Venezuela, China, you know, from the phone lines.
Or anything else, I'm happy to try and do it.
For those on the phone lines, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset and make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, for phone questions, that's star 1.
I guess we'll take it into the room then for the questions.
Let's hope I didn't put them all to sleep. It's early in the day.
Bill, you didn't mention Puerto Rico. What do you see there, and how do you see them developing?
I think that's another unfortunate situation because I think all the major political parties are at fault. You know, the heavy borrowing that they made there. And, of course, I think it was a major error of the U.S. Treasury when they cut the tax, you know, provisions because a lot of industries closed down and they were living off of that. And the private sector hasn't stepped up like it used to. Teddy Moscoso was sort of a hero to me. He was the ambassador at the time of JFK and up in Venezuela. I got to know him, and he's the one who invented Operation Bootstrap, which basically took a poor area, poorest area in the United States, and lifted it up. And he mobilized the private sector, and because of that, JFK, when he formed the Alliance for Progress, named Teddy Moscoso as the head. And 936, all of these tax schemes came in. And you had a very good, representation of the private sector and the government working together, Development Bank, to kind of lift Puerto Rico up. But then you got one government after another, forget about the party, taking on tremendous amounts of debt. And a lot of this was taken on, as you know, by the savings unions there and the, you know, one thing or another. And so a lot of this paper is held, you know, by Puerto Ricans who don't have that much money. And then the incompetence, like the electrical company there, I mean, it's not only incompetence. A lot of people think it's worse than that. They think there's corruption there. And so I blame a lot of this on the governments of Puerto Rico, all the various parties, and I've known a number of the governors. And I think it was a mistake not to try and go to statehood because they would have gotten some of the benefits and some of the discipline, particularly from the IRS on taxes. And so, you know, I feel bad because I used to travel there quite a bit when I was running the Caribbean. You know, I ran Latin America, but before that I ran the Caribbean for Citibank. I used to go there quite a lot, and those were the days when things were working well. They took the tax benefits away under Clinton. Bob Rubin says he doesn't remember doing it, but he signed off on it. And that was sort of the beginning, and then this tremendous amount of borrowing that they've done. And then, when you have something go bad, and it really goes bad, like I mentioned in Venezuela, you had this hurricane and what happened thereafter. Now, it's an opportunity, I think, for Puerto Rico to rejuvenate itself. But I think long run, you really need to have statehood. Now, someone who once worked for me years and years and years ago, and then she became mayor of San Juan and then governor, first woman to become governor, she and I have discussed this, and she's the head of the Commonwealth Party, or was head of it, and she gave me all these reasons why they shouldn't do it. And I said, I think now you're going to have to change your mind. But Celia, my friend Celia, is that Celia Calderon, is that long run, that's what they really need to do. But they've got to draw investment. One of the opportunities they had, and they didn't take advantage, and now it's going to be more difficult, is tourism. Because when Cuba went under, that's why Jamaica developed tourism and all these other islands in the Caribbean,
is because, you know, the favorite spot was cut off. But now that Cuba is more open, and the costs are so much lower, it's going to be tough for Puerto Rico on the tourist side. And they need a lot of investment in that area. The other area, which is very bad, and those of you who travel there know, is crime. The carjacking, the drugs, you really have a problem there in that area, and they've got to do something about controlling, because it's a favorite area for Colombia to run the, you know, to run stuff through, you know, through Puerto Rico. And as I said, because the unemployment rate, the carjackings, everything else, so it makes it tough on tourism as well. So what you really need there is someone like my friend Teddy Moscoso, who was given full authority. You need a czar, a business czar, to really get in there with full support of the governor to kind of work on some of these things. And you need the support of the U.S. administration, obviously, to turn the place around. And what you have is, you know, the original migration of Puerto Ricans to the United States was basically here in New York, which was right after World War II, during World War II, etc. Really after World War II. And that's, as I said before, Teddy Moscoso really got his Operation Bootstrap going. And they basically came to New York. But they were not business people. They were not lawyers, doctors, etc. They were sort of the, you know, the poor end of the population who wanted an opportunity to better themselves, and so they came here. What's going on now is you have the elite of the country leaving: doctors, lawyers, architects, teachers, and I'm not sure how many of these are going to come back. So many, for instance, have gone to Florida and they find a home in Florida because, you know, bilingual, and I think to me that maybe the most serious problem of all is having lost the educated, the cream of the crop classes that moved out. Are they going to come back? The ones that went up here to New York to stay with family, are probably more will go back. The ones in Florida, not clear to me that they're going to go back, and I think that's a major, major problem. So I was contacted by the fellow who was working on this and the Obama administration, if I had any ideas. And I gave them what few ideas I had at the time. But this new system they put in place, I'm not sure how well that's working out. Because what I think the country needs is to get, a czar in there, something like Teddy Moscoso. And to talk to anyone in Washington, who's Teddy Moscoso? They don't even know who he was. You ask him about Operation Bootstrap, and these are people in the Obama administration and this administration, Trump administration. They don't even know what Operation Bootstrap was. They have no sense of the history of Puerto Rico, which I think is unfortunate. It's just like the Chinese tell us that we have no sense of the history of China, which I write about in my book. And if you're dealing with any of these situations, it's like Venezuela, you have to understand the history, country, what's going on and stuff. And I think that's a quid pro quo for getting anything done. So I'm hopeful for Puerto Rico, but I can't say I'm particularly optimistic. You know, maybe if they do things properly, they'll get some of that investment back. But what's troubling me most of all, as I said, is the loss of the educated population that may not come back, particularly those in Florida. Because there you can't, that's difficult to replace, because then you get into a generation problem to do that. And I blame the politicians there for, you know, not recognizing what needed to be done. And the politicians here in the United States not giving damn about Puerto Rico, because they treated Puerto Rico like it wasn't part of the United States. So that would be my long-winded answer to the short question. Now, if you want to talk about restructuring techniques, then you guys here know more about what's going on there than I do.
So, questions on the line or in the room? I've got one.
Just one quick one. Sort of slightly topical right now with sanctions in Russia, or potentially sort of expanded in that front. How do you think that plays a role in Venezuela on a go-forward basis, if any?
I think that's a key question because we keep placing more sanctions on there. You have the Citgo situation and everything else. That's why I mentioned China and Russia have got to be taken into account. And the Chinese and Russians don't necessarily agree on how things ought to work out in Venezuela because they have different interests in some ways. So I think that'll even complicate it even more because, you know, Putin remembers very well the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was basically because the Soviet Union was supporting Castro and the threat of putting, you know, they had major military base there, you know, putting nuclear weapons there, but they're on the road to reestablishing military bases in Cuba. And they look at the Venezuelan-Cuban connection like this. And one of the things you're going to have to take into account is, I think, and Garrigan in Washington, I go back to the Bush administration where I won't get into the name, but one of the cabinet members asked me to lunch in the White House and was my views on the Middle East because at that point Iraq was the big situation. And I tried to tell them about Chavez, who I know, and they didn't take it seriously. And we haven't taken Latin America seriously, and we haven't taken Venezuela seriously. I mean, we're taking Mexico seriously, that and NAFTA, but we haven't taken Venezuela seriously. And I'm not sure we have a plan for Venezuela as a country. But I think the Russians obviously want to use that. And so I think that'll be very much part of it. And you know, that, I think that if Chavez hadn't come along and supported the Castros, Cuba might have had to open up earlier because the Russians had pulled out completely. They pulled their military bases out. They pulled all their economic support out after the fall of the Soviet Union. I remember talking to Cheremirdin about that because I was head of his international advisory committee. I headed the economic financial side. I was under Yeltsin. And they had no interest in Cuba. They pulled everything out. But the one who kept the Castros in power was this almost gifting oil to them that kept them going. Same thing with Daniel Ortega, who I sat across from negotiating the debt in 1980. And that's another story for another time. So I think it's very important. And this is eventually the U.S. government's going to have to take Venezuela into account because of this. Let's hope they do. I've made the point down there to my contact, but we made the point when we were down there.
Excuse the alliteration, but you sat across or with some amazing people as you've done your work over the last 50, 60 years in the emerging markets, dictators and Democrats, bankers and bureaucrats. You've even spoke Cubas with Castro. Daniel Ortega story. How important sort of character been along the way? How do you sort of assess the people that you're dealing with on the other side of the table or beside you on the table and kind of motivations and sort of things like capacity to pay versus willingness to pay?
Well, to start off with, when you're dealing with people like that, you have to be a good listener because what you really want to do is to figure out what they're thinking. So I tried with Castro to be a good listener, with Xi Jinping being a good listener. I also had an instance in Russia, since you brought up Russia, with Mayor Luchkov, who in the first part of Putin's reign in Russia was his closest associate as mayor of Moscow. And he later had to leave because his wife was a contractor and several of her buildings collapsed and there was an accusation of corruption. But I remember at one of the meetings I had with him, I think it was, yeah, we had lunch and tea in his offices, and this is under the Bush administration. that he said something to me which I'll always remember because I think it's very pertinent for today and the future. And this is on a sort of strategic side. He said to me, he said, Bill, I don't understand the policies of the Bush administration. This is Bush 2 now. He said, you're, I think she was, before, she wasn't Secretary of State then, she was National Security Advisor, Condi Rice, who's a friend. And she said, and she's a Russian expert. And he said, you know, she's so anti-us, and I don't understand why, because we ought to realize that the real enemy for the future is China. He said, they're envious of us because they think most of Siberia is theirs, and we're going to have problems in Central Asia, and the United States and Russia want to combine to really oppose them. And he particularly mentioned how the Han Chinese were going to move into Mongolia, control Mongolia, and further. And he said, we have very few people in Siberia. They have hundreds of millions in northern China, the Han Chinese. Didn't just say the Chinese, said the Han. And the only thing I could answer him was, I said, Mr. Mayor, when I think about what you're talking about, I think about going to the National Museum of in China, which I think probably has been changed now, excuse me, my voice. And on one wall, they had this enormous mural of the Cossacks, you know, charging after fleeing Chinese. This is under the Qing Dynasty. And I pointed out to him that the Chinese have a good sense of history and never forget. And they remember that under the Qing Dynasty, a good part of Siberia was controlled by the Qing Dynasty. And, you know, you basically took it from them. And they have not forgotten that. And so I agree with you that there will be at some point a problem between Russia and China over Central Asia. And that was the end of the conversation because he had expected me to be sympathetic with his view. And where I do see conflict coming up, that's why I think the relationship between Russia and China today is very short-term oriented, because as you get the Silk Road, you know, One Belt, One Road moving into Central Asia, and Putin's plan for what Russia wants to do in Central Asia, they are going to, at some point, they're going to bluntly have, you know, meet and push against each other. And I think that is something we're going to see in the future, because it all goes back to that period where under the Qing Dynasty, and it's even before, because the Silk Road goes back 1,000 years before. But the idea is that there will eventually be a problem there, and I think it'll come sooner rather than later. And so I think that's something that our policymakers ought to keep very much in mind. And I don't want to, since we're on open line here, but one of the chief, let's say, most brilliant policymakers we ever had on both these countries, you probably can figure out who I mean, former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, and I've discussed this on a number of occasions, and he agrees with me. So when we talk about our conflict in the South China Sea and everything with China, yeah, it's there, but longer term, you have that conflict out there. And so that's why I'm saying that what the Russians and Chinese want is not always the same, notwithstanding all these meetings between the leadership. And so that's something to look forward to going forward. So I think that we need to keep our relationship with China on a decent basis, but we have to stand up for our rights. And I think on the trade side, whereas we don't have a problem with Russia on the trade side, with China we do, but, you know, the truth of it is, when Zhu Rongji negotiated the WTO, he was a great negotiator. And, you know, we were supposed to enforce some of the limitations, and, you know, if they basically didn't abide by that stuff, we were supposed to do something about it, and we basically didn't do anything about it. And I talked to one of the trade negotiators on that, and she got very upset with me, saying, well, that's not how it was, Bill, you know, this and that and everything else. Well, I watched it firsthand. So you find a lot of sympathy in the United States for dealing with China on trade and intellectual property. But on the other hand, the Chinese really don't want to butt up against us. And so we're going to just have to be firm in our negotiations. But we lost the opportunity to do something under, you know, during Clinton, during Bush, and during Obama. And we should have been more forceful in some of this stuff. So we have no one to blame but ourselves. I remember when they put it in, and they were implementing WTO, the head of the CBRC, who was a friend, told our CBANC's head of operations in China that they had decided that they wanted all foreign banks to not move forward on what they were then, branches. They wanted to incorporate locally with their own capital, and they wanted to have the right. They insisted on having so many Chinese representatives on the board, including the right to have a member of the government on the board. CBRC to attend meetings of the board. And that wasn't part of the arrangement with the WTO. And we let it slide. And that's because the individual institutions were told, if you want additional branches and you want anything else, you better agree to this. And that's how it's been in the car industry. It's been in all of these industries. Because it basically said, if you want this market, you got to do it our way or the highway. And nobody really raised their hand much in that way. So we are where we are today. Let's hope we handle it. I mean, we handle it properly, because we're going to have to live with China for a long time to come. It's just like the NAFTA thing. I think that we need an agreement with NAFTA before Lopez Obrador wins the presidency. Now, he may not win it, but right now he's favored to win it, because I've sat with him and he has some different ideas. I had dinner with him last year, and he has some different ideas than we do. So if we're smart, we'll get some deal with the present government, and hopefully Lopez Obrador will live up to it. We'll have to see. And I think it was also a major mistake to leave the TPP, because although it's much more difficult, and I helped negotiate for the private sector side, the original NAFTA, Korea, as chairman of the U.S. Korea Business Council and chairman of the Council of the Americas, the Colombia Agreement, the Panama Agreement, all those, the Caribbean agreements. And it's much easier to do those. In that sense, the administration's correct in doing a multilateral one like a TPP. But TPP was put together to basically say to the Chinese, you can't have your way in Asia. You know, there are other countries here. And we, first thing that this president did was walk away from it. What was it, 48 hours, 72 hours after he took office? He walked away. Now we're talking about getting back in. Well, it's always easier if you come in at the beginning to get your way. So we'll see how that works. And, of course, no one was happier to see that the United States leave that agreement than China. In fact, the Chinese don't kind of understand how we're running things here.
We probably have time for one more question. If there's a quick question on the line or in the room.
No questions from the phone lines.
Just real quick, you talked about the perils of the rising debt, and we talked a lot about the emerging market space, but where do you have any concerns with regards to places like Japan, the U.S., and Europe, and kind of more G7-type countries that have leveraged themselves quite a bit and have central bank balance sheets that are far more extended than they were at the last crisis? And how bad do you think this next bear market could be?
Well, I could spend the whole rest of the afternoon on that, but just starting off with Japan, one of the great economists on the emerging markets and Asia was a professor at MIT called Rudy Dornbusch. And Rudy always felt that if the Chinese didn't get their debt to GDP down, which is, you know, really basically higher than China's, that it was going to blow up in their face. Now, what saved them is almost all of that is in the hands of Chinese enterprises, etc. It's not held internationally. But I think that Japan still has to find a way to reduce that tremendous debt burden that they have. And they have a lot of other problems with aging, etc. And, of course, now you have the scandals, which are periodic, with Abe. I'm a friend of Kuroda, and Kuroda is trying to do the job, which is get inflation up, but it hasn't been easy. The growth has come back somewhat, but they are always liable to this problem of the tremendous debt burden that they have. The population itself is diminishing, so they've got a lot of problems in Japan, which is why Abe is one of the chief pushers of TPP, because he basically needs it, because he wants to force open the agricultural area. You know, he wants to force open some of these areas that have been sacrosanct in Japan to make Japan more competitive. Because let's face it, Japan has lost out a lot to Korea and China in a lot of the markets they dominate with technology. I think with regards to Europe, I think the only strong leader in Western Europe today is Macron, and he is yet to show that he can bring everything off, but he's trying very hard to kind of revolutionize the economy in France. You have weak leadership in the UK. Merkel has been hurt quite a bit and no longer has her ability. Italy is a problem, has been a problem. If you had a real referendum in that country, they'd leave. An open referendum, because they're the country that's gotten leased out of the Eurozone, frankly. Spain has done very well. Portugal's come along, but Spain still has to deal with Catalonia, but they've done okay. Greece is still a mess, notwithstanding starting to get some growth back into it. So I look to Macron to be kind of leading light, but he's got to clean up his own country before he revolutionizes the Eurozone or the ECB, and that's one of the dangers. He tries to get too much on that track before he cleans up his own country, first. In the case of Russia, way overly dependent on energy. They actually have as an advisor, but I don't know how much he listens to him. I think the greatest finance minister in modern Russian history, maybe the greatest finance minister in history of Russia, which is Alexei Kudrin. He's the one who got them out of the debt crisis. He keeps telling Putin he's got to diversify the economy. He didn't do it. He also told him don't go into Crimea, because all you do is alienate the Europeans, particularly. And he said, we're really more part of Europe rather than Asia. And he only goes to Kudrin when he's in trouble. But Kudrin holds no particular position. He's a professor at the University of St. Petersburg. And so basically, Putin hasn't done anything to help the economy. If anything, they're more dependent on ever. And they're getting more dependent on China, which, if you were Russian, that may not be the best thing. And particularly when you're playing cards against Xi Jinping. So I would, that's how I covered. India, I haven't saying about, the hope of India is Modi, but they've got a lot of problems in the sense that you can't install things like you can in China, because you're talking about a dictatorship on one hand and a living democracy on the other. And they got all sorts of problems, you know, Muslim, Hindu, all sorts of things. But Modi is a great hope for India. We'll have to see how it works out, but it's not going to be easy. One thing I would say, I was an advisor to Mandela and was on Thabo Mbeki's International Advisory Committee, and I was very happy to see that they pushed Zuma out and you got Cyril Ramaphosa there, because that's the economy in Africa which I think has the most potential, along with Nigeria. And Nigeria just seems to be always in trouble for one thing. The amount of corruption there is just mind-boggling. And so we have to see if South Africa, which has so much potential, can turn itself around. As far as the Middle East goes, I think it's a real mess. I think the opening up in Saudi, I do not know the Crown Prince. I have not been recently to Saudi. I used to go there all the time. I think what he's trying to do is really important if Saudi is not going to be another Iran. My question is methods, but he's trying to open the place up, which I think is necessary. But Iran is a clear and present danger, because if you take a look at where Iran was 20 years ago and where it is today, you really have a Shia crescent in the sense of their position today in Syria, in Iraq, and now with this thing with Qatar, what's going to come out of that. So you really have more than you've seen in modern times, this confrontation between the Sunnis, you know, led by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and the Iranians. And we've had very bad luck dealing with Iran historically. What do you give it to the Shah? What happened afterwards? And so I think that's a real problem also. And I have no idea, but if you listen to half of what, and believe half of what this president says, and our new national security advisor, we may not agree to go along with the with that agreement that Obama signed with Iran, which would open up another problem. So I think the Middle East is still a tinderbox. You just saw the raid there, and then you have Turkey. Remember, Turkey was the great example of coming out of a debt problem. I advised the Turks and the IMF on that and helped put together that deal with Turkey, and from then on they had anywhere between 8% and 10% growth. And now under Erdogan, you only have real problems with the currency, you have real problems with the private sector, and relationship between the head of state and the private sector. And so you've got real sort of economic problems. Take a look at it. It's close compared to what it was for 10 years in a row. It was a star of the Middle East and one of the highest growth rates, along with Peru, in the whole world and China. So I would say all of those are areas you have to watch. Now, if you're a trader, you can make a lot of money on these things. And if Hans does the right thing on deciding what positions you want to take, so can all of you.
That's great. Bill, thank you. You've your response to that last question really makes the title of your book apt. I appreciate all of you being here and the folks that joined us on the conference line. Greylock's glad you're here. Please, if you haven't eaten, grab some lunch. Bill's going to sign a few books.
Judge,
and,
I didn't bring my signing pen with me, so if someone has a good. You have one.
Yeah. Did you have any last comment or two?
Anything I'll say would pale in comparison. Mm-hmm. Bill, just...
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all again for your participation. You may now disconnect.